For the next several days, the brothers held private conferences, lasting long after dark. But on the morning of the third day, Esteban Acabal stepped outside to announce that a statement would be read at noon outside the compound where their prisoners were being held. With the sun directly overhead, Xebalanque, Junapu, and Acabal walked out of Xebalanque's hut toward the prisoners' compound. As they moved, surrounded by their followers and the reporters, Junapu's shoulders tensed when he heard the midday army fly over. The sound of the helicopters always made him nervous. Once there, they waited until the sound equipment was tested. Several of the technicians were wearing Hero Twin t-shirts. Acabal explained that the statement would be read in two parts, the first by Junapu and the second by Xebalanque. They would speak in Maya, and he, Acabal, would translate them into Spanish and English. Junapu clutched his piece of paper nervously. Acabal had been aghast to learn that he couldn't read, so he had had to memorize the speech the teacher had written. He thanked the gods for Jose's training in remembering rituals and spells. Junapu stepped closer to his microphone and saw Maxine wave in encouragement. Mentally, he asked the gods not to make him look foolish. When he began to speak, his nervousness vanished, drowned in his anger. "Since the time of your first coming to our lands, you have murdered our children. You have sought to destroy our beliefs. You stole our land and our sacred objects. You enslaved us. You have allowed us no voice in the destruction of our homes. If we spoke out, you kidnapped us, tortured us, and killed us for being men and not the malleable children you wanted. It is now that the cycle ends. We, Hakwinik, true men, will be free again to live as we wish to live. From the ice of the far north to the firelands of the south, we will see the coming of a new world in which all our people can be free. The gods are watching us now, and they wish to be worshipped in the old proper ways. In return, they will give us the strength we need to overcome those who will try to defeat us again. My brother and I are the signs of this new world to come." As he stepped back, Junapu heard his name being cried out by the thousands of Maya in Caminalhuyu. He looked over the ruined city in pride, soaking in the strength that his people's worship gave him. Maria had made it to the front of the gathered followers. She raised her arms to him in praise, and hundreds of people around her did the same. The gesture spread through the crowd. When it seemed that everyone had lifted their hands to implore his help, Junapu lifted his face and his arms toward heaven. The noise swelled until he dropped his hands and gazed over the people. Silence fell. Xebalanque stepped forward.
"We are not Ladino. We do not want a war or more death. We seek only what is ours by right, a land, a country that is ours. This land will be the homeland of any American Indian, no matter where in the Americas he was born. It is our intent to meet the WHO wildcard delegation while it is in Guatemala City. We will ask for their aid and support in founding a Hakwinik homeland. The God touched among our people are especially in need of immediate help. We do not ask now. We are telling you. Koosh, let us go." Xebalanque raised his fist in the air and chanted the Lacandon phrase over and over until every Indian in the camp joined him.
Junapu joined the chant and felt the rush of power once again. Watching Xebalanque, He knew his brother felt it as well. It felt right. It was clear that the gods were with them. Hunapu and Xabalanque flanked Acabal as he translated what they had said. The hero twins stood immobile and silent as the teacher refused to answer any other questions. Their people faced them, as silent and stoic now as themselves. When Acabal led the way back to their houses, where they would wait for word from the WHO delegation, their followers parted without a sound to allow them to pass, but closed in before the press could get through. Well, one can't accuse them of lacking political savvy. Senator Greg Hartman uncrossed his legs and got up out of the colonial reproduction chair to turn off the hotel room television set.
A little chutzpah never hurts, Greg.
Hiram Worcester leaned his head on his hand and looked over at Hartman.
But what do you think our response should be?
Response? What response can we possibly make? Senator Lyons interrupted Hartman's answer. We are here to help the victims of the wild card virus. I see no connection whatsoever. These revolutionaries, or whatever they are simply trying to use us. We have a responsibility to ignore them. We can hardly afford to become involved in some petty nationalistic squabble. Lyons crossed his arms and walked over to the window. Unobtrusively, a young Indian maid was led into the room to pick up the remains of their room service lunch. Head down, she glanced at each of them before silently carrying her heavily loaded tray out the door. Hartman shook his head at Senator Lyons.
I understand your point, but did you look at the people out there? A lot of the people who are following these hero twins are jokers. Don't we have a responsibility toward them?
Hartman relaxed back into his chair and rolled his back in an attempt to get comfortable. Besides, we can't afford to ignore them. It would compromise our own mission if we pretended they and their problems didn't exist. The world here is very different from what you're used to seeing, even on the reservations. There are different attitudes. The Indians have been suffering since the conquest. They take the long view. To them, the wild card virus is just another cross to bear.
Sad, Senator. You think those boys are aces, like the reporters say?
Mordecai Jones looked across the hotel room at the Wyoming senator.
Gotta say, I've got some sympathy for what they're trying to do. Slavery, whatever they call it down here, ain't right.
It's obvious that we are involved because of the wild card victims, if nothing else. If meeting with them will help them to get aid, we have a responsibility to do what we can.
Tachyon spoke from his chair.
On the other hand, I hear lots of talk about homelands, and I see very little commitment to working on practical problems. Problems such as the subsistence level of the victims here. You can see that they need medical help. What do you think, Hiram?
Greg's right. We can't avoid a meeting. There's been too much publicity. Beyond that, we are here to see how jokers are treated in other countries. Judging by what we've seen, we could help out down here by leaning on the government a little. This would appear to be a good way to do it. We don't have to endorse their actions, just express our concern.
That sounds reasonable. I'll let you deal with the politics. I need to get to that hospital tour.
Tachyon massaged one temple. I'm tired of talking to the government. I want to see what's going on. The door to the sitting room opened, and Billy Ray peered in. The phones are ringing off the hooks, and we've got reporters coming up the fire stairs. What are we supposed to tell them? Hartman nodded to Tachyon before answering.
Those of us who can spare the time from our carefully timed schedules will see these hero twins. But make it clear that we are doing this in the interests of the wild card victims, not for political reasons. Great. The father, Chrysalis, and Xavier ought to be back soon. They went out to see the camp and talked to the Jokers there. Anticipating Tachyon's next question, he smiled at the doctor. Your car is waiting downstairs, but the sooner you can give me an official statement for the press, the better. I'll have my people start drafting one immediately, Billy. Hartman was obviously on familiar ground. You'll have it within the hour.
In the morning, everyone gathered, hungover and bleary from the previous night's celebrations, but ready to march off to see the United Nations tour. When Hunapu and Xibalanque came out of their houses, the crowd became quiet. Xibalanque looked out over the people and wished that it were possible to have them follow him into the city. It would look great on film, but Akabal was convinced that it might just be the excuse the government was looking for to open fire. He jumped up onto the hood of the bus that had been chosen to take them into the city. He spoke for almost half an hour before the people appeared to agree that they would stay in Caminalhuyu. They arrived at the Camino Real without incident. The only surprise had come from the crowds of Indians lining the streets as they passed. The watchers were silent and impassive, but both Hunapo and Xibalanque were strengthened by their presence. At the Camino Real, they jumped down from the truck and were escorted within the building by two of their own guards and almost a score of UN security people. Xibalanque and Hunapo wore their closest approximation of the dress of the ancient kings. Hair tied up in warrior's knots on top of their heads, they were dressed in cotton tunics and dyed cotton wrap skirts. Hunapo was used to wearing only his shikul, a knee-length tunic. He felt at home in the ancient style. Xibalanque had spent the early morning tugging on his skirt and feeling self-conscious about his exposed legs. As he looked curiously around the hotel, he saw himself in a wall mirror. He almost stopped in wonder at the vision of a Mayan warrior looking back at him. Xibalanque straightened and raised his head, showing off his jade earplug.
Hunapu's eyes darted from one side of the lobby to the other. He had never seen a building this big with so many strange decorations and oddly dressed people. A fat man in a shiny white shirt and brightly colored flowered short pants stared at them. The tourist grabbed his wife, who wore a dress that was made on the same loom as the man's pants, by the arm and pointed at them. Catching a glimpse of Xibalanque, walking proudly alongside steadied Hunapu. But it was all he could do not to cry out prayers to the gods when they walked into a room slightly smaller than his family's house, and the doors slid shut without a human touch. The room moved under him, and only Xabalanque's calm face kept him from believing he was about to die. He slid his glance toward Akabal. The Maya in Western dress was clenching and releasing his fists rhythmically. Hunapu wondered if he was praying too. Despite his outward impassivity, Xibalanque was the first one out the opening doors when the elevator reached its destination. The entire group walked down the carpeted hall to a door flanked by two more UN soldiers. There were a few moments of discussion before it was agreed that, once the Indian guards had inspected the meeting room, they would retire outside the door until the conference was over. The hero twins would be allowed to keep their ceremonial stone knives, however. During this, Xibalanque and Hunapu said nothing, allowing Akabal to make the arrangements. Hunapu watched everything while he attempted to look like a warrior king. Being in these enclosed spaces made him nervous. He repeatedly looked to his brother for guidance. Inside the hotel room, the WHO delegates waited for them. Akabal immediately noticed Peregrine's cameraman.
Out! No cameras, no tapes!
The tall Indian turned to Hartman. It was agreed, at your insistence. Peregrine, the lady with the wings, is one of us. She is only interested in making a historical record,
which you can edit to suit your own purposes. No.
Hartman smiled and shrugged at Peregrine.
Perhaps it would be better if...
Sure. No problem.
She flapped her wings lazily and directed her cameraman to leave.
Xibalanque noted that Akabal seemed to be thrown off by the ease at which he had gotten his wish. He turned to look at his brother. Hunapu appeared to be communing directly with the gods. It was clear from looking at him that nothing here was of interest. Xibalanque tried to capture the same assurance.
Good. Now, we are here to discuss... Akabal began his prepared introduction, but was interrupted by Hartman. Let's be informal here. Everyone please have a seat. Mr. Akabal, why don't you sit beside me since I believe you'll be doing the translating here?
Hartman sat down at the head of a table apparently brought into the room for the meeting, since the furniture around it had been moved against the walls.
Do the other gentlemen speak English?
Xibalanque was about to reply when he caught Akabal's warning glance. Instead, he guided Hunapu to a chair.
No, I'll be translating for them as well.
Hunapu stared earnestly at the tentacled priest and the man with the nose like Chak, the long-nosed rain god. He was pleased that the god touched would travel with this group. It was an auspicious sign, but he was also surprised to see a father who was so blessed by the gods. Perhaps there was more to what the priests had tried to teach him than he had previously believed. He mentioned his thoughts to Akabal, who spoke in English to Hartman.
Among our people, the victims of the wild card virus are regarded as being favored by the gods. They are revered, not persecuted.
And that's what we're here to talk about, isn't it? Your people.
Hartman had not stopped smiling since they'd entered the room. Xibalanque did not trust a man who showed his teeth so much. The man with the elephant's trunk spoke next. This new country of yours, would it be open to all jokers? Xibalanque pretended to listen to Akabal's translation. He replied in Maya, knowing that Akabal would change his words anyway. This homeland takes back only a tiny part of what has been stolen from us. It is for our people, whether God touched or not. The God touched of the Ladinos have other places to go for help.
But why do you feel a separate nation is necessary? It seems to me that your show of political power would impress the Guatemalan government with your strength. They're bound to introduce the reforms you want.
Hartman brought the conversation back to Akabal, which didn't displease Hunapu. He could feel hostility in this room and a lack of understanding. Whatever else they were also Ladinos.
He looked over at Akabal as the man replied to one of the Norteamericanos' questions.
You aren't listening. We don't want reforms. We want our land back. But only a small part of it at that. Reforms have come and gone for 400 years. We are tired of waiting.
Akabal was vehement.
Do you know that to most Indians this wild card virus is just another smallpox? Another white disease brought to us to kill as many as possible?
That's ridiculous. Senator Lyons was enraged at the accusation. Humans had nothing to do with the wild card virus. We came here to help you. That is our only purpose. In order to help, we feel we have to have the cooperation of the government.
Senator Lyons seemed to be on the defensive.
We spoke to the general. He's planning to put clinics in the outlying provinces and to bring serious cases of the wild card outbreak here to the city for treatment.
The brothers exchanged glances. It was clear to each man that these strangers from the north were not about to do anything for them.
Hunapu was getting impatient. There were too many things they could be doing in Cabinalhuyu. He wanted to start teaching the uninformed about the old gods and the means of worshipping them.
We can't change the past. We both know that.
So what's the point? Why are you here?
Hartman had stopped smiling.
We are going to form an Indian nation, but we will need help. Akabal spoke firmly.
Shivalanke approved of his lack of tolerance for distraction, even though he wasn't altogether sure about Akabal's plans for a socialist government.
Do you have no idea of what the United Nations is? Surely you cannot expect us to provide weapons for your war. Senator Lyon's mouth was ringed with white from his anger. No, no weapons. But if you had come out to see our followers, you would have seen how many have been untreated by the Ladino doctors in the hope that they would not survive. And yes, I know what the general told you. We will need much medical aid initially to care for these people. After that, we will need aid for schools, roads, transportation, agriculture. All the things a real country must provide. You understand, we're only on a fact-finding tour. We don't have any real authority with the UN or even with the US government for that matter. Hartman leaned back in his seat and spread his hands. Sympathy is about all we can offer at this time. We are not about to jeopardize our standing in the international community for your military adventures. Senator Lyons' eyes swept the three Indians. Hunapu was not impressed. Women should stay out of serious decisions. This is a peaceful mission. There is nothing political about suffering, and I don't intend to see you try to make the wild card virus a pawn in your bid for attention, Lyons said. I doubt if the European Jews of the Holocaust would agree that suffering is apolitical, Senator. Akabal watched Lyons' expression change to chagrin. The wild card virus has affected my people. That is the truth. My people face active genocide. That, too, is truth. If you don't want the wild card virus involved, that's nice, but it's not really possible, is it? What do we want from you? Just two things. Humanitarian aid and recognition. For the first time, Akabal looked a little unsure of himself. Soon, the Guatemalan government is going to try to destroy us. They'll wait until you are gone, you and the reporters following you. We don't intend to allow them to succeed. We have certain advantages.
They're aces, then. Hartman had grown suddenly quiet and introspective.
Some of the reporters had used that term, and Akabal had mentioned it, but this was the first time Shivalanke felt that it would fit. He felt like an ace. He and his brother, the little Lakandon, could take anyone. They were the incarnations of the priest kings of their fathers, favored by the gods, or an alien disease. It didn't matter. They would lead their people to victory. He turned to Hunapu and saw that it was as if his brother shared his thoughts.
To them, they have been called to serve the old gods and be the heralds of the new age, the beginning of the next cycle. By our calendar, that will be in your year, 2008. They are here to prepare the way over the next Katun. Akabal looked back at the Norteamericanos. But yes, I believe that they are aces. The evidence fits. It is hardly unusual for an ace to exhibit powers that appear to be drawn from his cultural heritage, is it?
There were three short raps on the door. Shivalanke saw the security chief, the one they called Carnifex, look in. He wondered for a moment if this was all an elaborate trap.
The plane's ready and we need to leave within the next hour. Thanks. Hartman put his hand under his chin in thought. Speaking simply as a U.S. senator here, I'd like to see what we could work out, Mr. Akabal. Why don't we speak privately for a moment? Akabal nodded. Perhaps the father would like to talk to Shivalanke and Hunapu. The brother speaks Spanish, if there is a translator available.
When Hartman and Akabal ended their huddle and rejoined them, Shibalanke was ready to leave. Listening to Hunapu, he was becoming afraid that his brother was going to demonstrate calling on the gods right then and there. He knew that wasn't a good idea. Shibalanke was trying to explain this as Hartman shook Agabal's hand in farewell. To Shibalanke, it seemed as though he held on to the teacher's hand too long. North American customs. He went back to dissuading Hunapo from pulling his obsidian knife and began leading his brother out. When they were back in the elevator, escorted again by UN security people, Shibalanke asked Agabal in Maya what Hartman had said.
"Nothing. He will attempt to set up a committee to study the matter. He talks like all the Yankees. At least they saw us. It gives us legitimacy in the eyes of the world. That much was useful."
"They do not believe that we serve the will of the gods, do they?" Hunapu was much more angry than he had allowed himself to show. Shibalanke watched him warily. He looked his brother in the eyes. "We will show them the power of the gods. They will learn." Over the following 24 hours, they lost half the journalists covering them as the reporters went on with the UN tour. And the army moved more units into place and, more ominously, began to evacuate the surrounding suburbs. Finally, all travel into the camp was cut off. The peace from the anthropologist was welcome, but the intent was clear to everyone in Caminal Huyu. No non-combatants in the camp. At sunrise and noon for each of the 3 days since the visit to Hartman and the tour, Hunapu had sacrificed his own blood on the highest of the temple mounds of the city. Shibalanke had joined him at the last two sunrises. Akabal's pleas for common sense were ignored. As the tension within Caminal Huyu increased, the brothers grew more insular. Discussing their plans only with each other, they ignored most of the planning sessions held by Akabal and the rebel leaders. Maria spent all her time at Hunapu's side when she was not preparing an altar for a sacrifice. Bol constantly drilled the warriors. Shibalanke and Hunapu stood atop the ruined temple surrounded by their followers. It was nearly dawn on the fourth day. An ornate decorated bowl was held between them by Maria. Each man held his obsidian blade to the palm of his hand. At the rising of the sun, they would cut their flesh and let the blood pour down and mix together in the bowl before they burned it on the altar Maria had arranged with effigies and flowers. The sun was still behind the eastern volcano that loomed over Guatemala City and puffed smoke into the air as if constantly offering sacred tobacco to the gods. First light. Knives flashed back, shining. Blood flowed, mingled, filled the bowl. Hands, covered with red, lifted to the sun. Thousands of voices raised in a chant welcoming the day with a plea for mercy from the gods. 2 thatched huts exploded as the rays of the sun touched them. The dirt and debris rained down on the people. Those closest to the huts were the first to see that a government rocket had blown the shelters apart. The fighters ran for the perimeter to try to stop the invasion, while those who were unable to defend the camp drew together in a great mass at its center. The government rockets targeted the central plaza where several thousand people knelt and prayed or screamed as the rockets arced overhead to fall nearby. Maxine Chen was one of the few top journalists left to cover the Hero Twins' crusade. She and her crew had taken shelter behind one of the temple mounds where Maxine taped an introduction to the attack. An Indian girl, 7 or 8 years old, ran around the side of the mound and in front of Maxine's camera. Her face and her embroidered white huipil
were covered with blood, and she was crying out in fear as she ran. Maxine tried to grab her, but missed, and the girl was gone. Robert! Maxine looked across at her cameraman. He ducked out from under his camera and shoved it at the sound man, who barely caught it. Then they were both running into the crowd, getting them up and moving toward the small shelter of the mounds. On the edge of the ruins, the Hero Twins' people were firing down into the soldiers, causing some confusion but not enough damage. The rockets were coming from well behind the front lines of the army. The tank engines rumbled, but they held their ground and fired into the defenders, killing some and destroying the ruins that were their protection. Struggling against the flow of people into the center of Kaminalhuyu, Shabalanque and Hunapu managed to make their way to the front lines. They were cheered as their people spotted them. Standing out in the open, Shabalanque began throwing whatever he could get his hands on at the army. It had effect. The troops in front of his attack tried to move back, only to be stopped and ordered forward. Bullets ricocheted off his skin. The defending Indians saw this and drew strength from it. Aiming more carefully, they began to take a toll. But the rockets kept coming, and they could always hear the screams of the people trapped in the center of the camp. Hunapu flipped back and forth, using his knife to slit the throats of the nearest soldiers before returning to his own place. He targeted officers, as Acabal had warned him to do. But with the press of men behind them, the frontline troops could not flee even when they wanted to escape the demon.
Shabalanque ran out of missiles and retired behind one of the mounds. He was joined by two of the experienced guerrilla leaders. They were frightened by the mass carnage. It was different from a jungle war. When they saw Hunapu shift back, Shabalanque caught him before he could return. Hunapu's cotton armor was soaked with the soldiers' blood. The smell gagged even the rebels. The blood and the smoke from the guns took Shabalanque back to the first time he had experienced it. Shibalba, he spoke only to his brother.
Yes, Hunapu nodded. The gods have grown hungry. Our blood was not enough. They want more blood. Blood with power. A king's blood.
Do you think they would accept a general's blood? A war captain's? Shabalanque looked over his shoulder at the army on the other side of the dirt mound. The guerrillas were following the exchange closely, looking for a reason to hope for victory. Both nodded at the thought. If you can take the general, things will fall apart down the line. There are draftees out there, not volunteers. The man wiped dusty black hair out of his eyes and shrugged. It's the best idea I've heard.
Where is the war captain? Hunapu's eyes fixed on a distant goal. I will bring him back. It must be done correctly, or the gods will not be pleased.
He'll be in the rear. I saw a truck back there with lots of antennas, a communications center, over to the east. Shabalanque looked at his brother uneasily. Something felt wrong about him. Are you all right?
I serve my people and my gods. Hunapu walked a few steps away and vanished with a soft cluck.
I'm not sure that this is a good idea. Shabalanque wondered what Hunapu had in mind. Got a better one? He'll be okay. The rebel started to shrug, but was stopped with shoulders lifted by the sound of helicopters. Shabalanque, you've got to take them. If they can attack from the air, we are dead. Before the other man had finished, Shabalanque was running back toward the helicopters and the middle of Kaminalhuyu. As the brace of Hueys came into sight, he picked up a rock the size of his head and launched it. The helicopter to the left exploded in flames. Its companion pulled up and away from the camp. But Shabalanque
hadn't realized the position of the helicopter he had destroyed. Burning debris fell on his huddled followers, causing as much death and pain as a government rocket. Shibalanka turned away, cursing himself for being oblivious to his people, and saw Hunapo atop the tallest mound. His brother held a limp figure, half sprawled on the ground, beside Maria's altar. Shibalanka ran toward the temple. From the other side, Akabal had seen Hunapo appear with his captive. Akabal had been separated from the twins in the melee following the first mortar strike. Now he turned his back to the mass of followers jammed together around the central dirt mounds. Maxine Chen's tug on his arm stopped him. She joined him, her face filthy and sweating, and her two-man crew looking haggard. Robert had reclaimed his camera and filmed everything he could get as he moved around Kaminalhuyu.
"What's going on?"
She had to shout to be heard over the crowd and the guns.
"Who's that with Hunapo? Is it Shibalanka?"
Akabal shook his head and kept moving, followed by Chen. When she saw that Akabal intended to climb the mound in the open, she and Robert hesitated and followed him. The sound man shook his head and crouched at the base of the temple. Shibalanka had been met by Maria, and they scrambled up the other side. The cameraman stepped back and began filming as soon as all six had made it to the top.
Seeing Shibalanka, Hunapo lifted his face and began to chant to the sky. He no longer had his knife, and the dried blood that covered much of his face looked like ceremonial paint. Shibalanka listened for a moment and then shook his head. In an archaic Maya, he argued with Hunapo, who continued his chant, oblivious to Shabalanke's interruption. Maxine asked Akabal what was happening, but he shook his head in confusion. Maria had hauled the Guatemalan general onto the earthen altar and began to strip off his uniform. The guns ceased firing at the same moment Hunapo ended his chant and held out his hand to Shabalanke. In the silence, Maxine put her hands to her ears. Maria knelt beside the general, holding the offering bowl in front of her. Shibalanka backed away, shaking his head. Hunapo sharply thrust his arm out at Shibalanka. Looking over Hunapu's shoulder, Shibalanka saw the government tanks roll forward, tearing apart the fence and crushing the Indians under their treads. As Shibalanka hesitated, the general woke up. Finding himself stretched out on an altar, he cursed and tried to roll off. Maria shoved him back onto it. Noting her feathers, he held himself away from her as if he could be contaminated. He began haranguing Hunapo and Shibalanka in Spanish.
"What the hell do you think you are doing? The Geneva Convention clearly states that officer prisoners of war are to be treated with dignity and respect. Give me back my clothes!"
Shibalanka heard the tanks and screams behind him as the Guatemalan army officer cursed him. He tossed his obsidian knife to Hunapo and grabbed the general's flailing arms.
"Let me go! What do you savages think you're doing?"
As Hunapo raised the knife, the man's eyes widened.
"You can't do this! Please, this is 1986! You're all mad! Listen, I'll stop them. I'll call them off. Let me up! Please, Jesus, let me up!"
Shibalanka pinned the general back against the altar and looked up as Hunapo brought the knife down.
"Hail Mary, full of gr—"
The obsidian blade cut through flesh and cartilage, spraying the brothers and Maria with blood. Shibalanka watched in horrified fascination as Hunapo decapitated the general, bearing down with the knife against the spine and severing the final connections before lifting the Ladino's head to the sky. Shibalanka released the dead man's arms and, trembling, took the bowl filled with blood from Maria. Shoving the body off the altar, he set fire to the blood as Maria lit copal incense. He threw back his head and called the names of his gods to the sky. His voice was echoed by his people, gathered below with arms thrust into the air toward the temple. Hunapo placed the head, its eyes open and staring into Xibalba, on the altar. The tanks stopped their advance and began a lumbering retreat. The foot soldiers dropped their guns and ran. A few shot officers that tried to stop them, and the officers joined the flight. The government forces disbanded in chaos, scattering into the city, abandoning their equipment and weapons. Maxine had vomited at the sight of the sacrifice, but her cameraman had it all on tape. Shaking and pale, she asked Akabal what was happening. He looked down at her with wide eyes.
"It is the time of the fourth creation, the birth of Urakan, the heart of heaven, our home. The gods have returned to us. Death to the enemies of our people."
Akabal knelt and stretched his hands toward the hero twins.
"Lead us to glory, favored of the gods."
In room 502 of the Camino Real, a tourist in flowered shorts and a pale blue polyester shirt stuffed the last souvenir weaving into his suitcase. He looked around the room for his wife and saw her at the window.
"Next time, Martha, don't buy anything that won't fit into your suitcase."
He leaned his considerable weight on the bag and slid the catches closed.
"Where is that boy? We must have called half an hour ago. What's so interesting out there?"
"The people, Simon. It's some kind of procession. I wonder if it's a religious occasion."
"Is it a riot? With all this unrest we've been hearing about, the sooner we get out of here, the better I'm going to feel."
"No, they just seem to be going somewhere."
His wife continued to peer down at the streets filled with men, women, and children.
"They're all Indians, too. You can tell by the costumes."
"My God, we're going to miss our plane if they don't get a move on."
He glared at his watch as if it was responsible.
"Call again, will you? Where the hell could he be?"
From the Journal of Xavier Desmond. December 15th, 1986. En route to Lima, Peru. I have been dilatory about keeping up my journal. No entry yesterday or the day before. I can only plead exhaustion and a certain amount of despondence. Guatemala took its toll on my spirit, I'm afraid. We are, of course, stringently neutral, but when I saw the televised news reports of the insurrection and heard some of the rhetoric being attributed to the Mayan revolutionaries, I dared to hope. When we actually met with the Indian leaders, I was even briefly elated. They considered my presence in the room an honor, an auspicious omen, seemed to treat me with the same sort of respect or lack of respect they gave Hartman and Tachyon. And the way they treated their own jokers gave me heart. Well, I'm an old man, an old joker, in fact, and I tend to clutch at straws. Now the Mayan revolutionaries have proclaimed a new nation, an Amerindian homeland, where their jokers will be welcomed and honored. The rest of us need not apply. Not that I would care much to live in the jungles of Guatemala. Even an autonomous joker homeland down here would scarcely cause a ripple in Jokertown, let alone any kind of significant exodus. Still, there are so few places in the world where jokers are welcome, where we can make our homes in peace. The more we travel on, the more we see, the more I am forced to conclude that Jokertown is the best place for us, our only true home. I cannot express how much that conclusion saddens and terrifies me. Why must we draw these lines? These fine distinctions, these labels and barriers that set us apart. Ace and Nat and Joker, capitalist and communist, K Catholic and Protestant, Arab and Jew, Indian and Ladino, and on everywhere. And of course, true humanity is to be found only on our side of the line, and we feel free to oppress and rape and kill the other, whoever he might be. There are those on the stacked deck who charged that the Guatemalans were engaged in conscious genocide against their own Indian populations, and who see this new nation as a very good thing. But I wonder. The Mayas think jokers are touched by the gods, specially blessed. No doubt it is better to be honored than reviled for our various handicaps and deformities. No doubt. But we have the Islamic nation still ahead of us. A third of the world, someone told me. Some Muslims are more tolerant than others, but virtually all of them consider deformity a sign of Allah's displeasure. The attitudes of the true fanatics, such as the Shiites in Iran and the Nur sect in Syria, are terrifying, Hitlerian. How many jokers were slaughtered when the Ayatollah displaced the Shah? To some Iranians, the tolerance he extended to jokers and women was the Shah's greatest sin. And are we so very much better in the enlightened USA, where fundamentalists like Leo Barnett preach that jokers are being punished for their sins? Oh, yes, there's a distinction. I must remember that. Barnett says he hates the sins, but loves the sinners. And if we will only repent and have faith and love Jesus, surely we will be cured. Now, I'm afraid that ultimately Barnett and the Ayatollah and the Mayan priests are all preaching the same creed, that our bodies, in some sense, reflect our souls, that some divine being has taken a direct hand and twisted us into these shapes to signify his pleasure, the Mayas, or displeasure, Nur al-Allah, the Ayatollah, the fire breather. Most of all, each of them is saying that jokers are different. My own creed is distressingly simple. I believe that jokers and aces and gnats are all just men and women and ought to be treated as such. During my dark nights of the soul, I wonder if I'm the only one left who still believes this. Still brooding about Guatemala and the Mayas. A point I failed to make earlier, I could not help noticing that this glorious idealistic revolution of theirs was led by two aces and a gnat. Even down here, where jokers are supposedly kissed by the gods, the aces lead, and the jokers follow. A few days ago, it was during our visit to the Panama Canal, I believe, Digger Downs asked me if I thought the U.S. would ever have a joker president. I told him I'd settle for a joker congressman. I'm afraid Nathan Rabinowitz, whose district includes Jokertown, heard the comment and took it for some sort of criticism of his representation. Then, Digger wanted to know if I thought an ace could be elected president. A more interesting question, I must admit. Downs always looks half asleep, but he's sharper than he appears, though not in a class with some of the other reporters aboard the stacked deck, like Herman of AP or Morgenstern of the Washington Post. I told Downs that before this last wildcard day, it might have been possible. Barely. Certain aces, like the Turtle, still missing, the latest New York papers confirm, Peregrine, Cyclone, and a handful of others are first-rank celebrities, commanding considerable public affection. How much of that could translate to the public arena, and how well it might survive the rough give and take of a presidential campaign? That's a more difficult question. Heroism is a perishable commodity. J. Jack Braun was standing close enough to hear Digger's question and my reply. Before I could conclude, I wanted to say that the whole equation had changed this September, that among the casualties of Wildcard Day was any faint chance that an ace might be a viable presidential candidate. Braun interrupted. "They'd tear him apart," he told us. What if it was someone they loved, Digger wanted to know. "They love the four aces," Braun said. Braun is no longer quite the exile he was at the beginning of the tour. Tachyon still refuses to acknowledge his existence, and Hiram is barely polite, but the other aces don't seem to know or care who he is. In Panama, he was often in Fantasy's company, squiring her here and there, and I've heard rumors of a liaison between Golden Boy and Senator Lyon's press secretary, an attractive young blonde. Undoubtedly, of the male aces, Braun is the far most attractive in the conventional sense, although Mordecai Jones has a certain brooding presence. Downs has been struck by those two also. The next issue of Aces will feature a piece comparing Golden Boy and the Harlem Hammer, he informs me.
Warts and All by Kevin Andrew Murphy. Read for you by Richard Maul. December 18, 1986, Lima. A line of potted plants stood arrayed against the whitewashed walls of the Museo Larco. Trailing succulents mingled with shrubby annuals, and spindly vines stretched heavenward on trellis wires, the blossoms displaying all the colors of the old Andrew Lang colored fairy books Howard Mueller had owned as a child. Red, blue, yellow, pink, orange, crimson, lilac, and violet. The green were the cacti, most of which were wrinkled and warty. So was Howard, known to most in Jokertown simply as Troll. Tourists took pictures of them, a few angling the shot to get him, too. Howard was used to it. When you grew up a joker, you learned it was hard to avoid the stairs. When you reached 9 feet tall, it became almost impossible. Fortunately, Howard had also grown an extremely thick skin, at least physically. He heard the click of shutters behind him, the hushed exclamations in Spanish. ¡Ay, que la chingada! ¡Mira a ese puto! The Peruvian accent was different from the Puerto Rican he was used to, but there are only so many swear words, and when you worked hospital security, you heard all of them, especially in Jokertown. Puto literally meant man-whore, but idiomatically it was whatever insult you wanted. Howard wished his Spanish stretched further than that. Being 9 feet tall, he had also learned to plan his day accordingly. Back home, Howard's favorite spot for his day off was the reading room of the New York Public Library. Bibliophiles tended to be more interested in their books. Plus, Howard had learned to appreciate venues with vaulted ceilings, or no ceiling. He stooped to get a brochure from a wooden stand, selecting one of the English ones, and glanced at the photographic illustrations of various moths and butterflies to be found in the gardens. The text described Caligo idomeneus, the owl butterfly, named for the yellow eye spots on its wings that made it look like an owl's face. Copaxa sapatosa, a pretty gold Saturn moth with feathery antennae and lunular wing marks. And Ascalapha odorata and Tysania agrippina, the black witch moth and the white witch moth, two of the largest moths known by various colorful names throughout Latin America. Tara bruja, Spanish for witch moth. Also la sorcière noire for the black ones, if you spoke French. Supposedly if one flew over your head, you'd go bald. But if it landed on your hand, you'd win the lottery. Howard had been bald ever since he'd drawn his wild card. But winning the lottery would be nice. A few specimens of the Lepidoptera from the pamphlet fluttered around the museum garden. They were impressive, especially the white witch moths, as big across as a gnat's hand. Howard's hands were more substantial and green, but that let one mimic a cactus paddle. A moth alit upon it. Howard brought it closer. So, he asked it softly, do I win the lottery? The white witch fanned her wings as coolly as Anderson's Snow Queen might toy with a fan, apparently considering his question, then fluttered off across the lawn. Howard watched her go and chuckled, taking a moment to adjust the strap of the oversized novelty sunglasses he had purchased back in New York. Oversized was relative. They fit many jokers fine as plain sunglasses, Howard included. The novelty was finding them in his size. Almost everything had to be custom fit. Howard glanced back to the butterfly guide. The next name for the witch moth was Mariposa de la Muerte, the butterfly of death, though the pamphlet observed that this would be a better name for Lonomia obliqua, the giant silkworm moth. Its larval form was known as the assassin caterpillar since it injected an anticoagulant poison through wickedly barbed spines, resulting in several deaths every year. Megalopogae opercularis, the flannel moth, was even more dangerous. Nicknamed the Asp, its caterpillars, while less poisonous than the assassins, were bewitchingly cute. They looked like fluffy lost toupees in the photograph, but had the poisoned spines hidden beneath silky yellow hair. Howard wasn't much worried about poison himself. His hard skin was tough as an elephant's hide, but the flannel moth caterpillars looked like they'd be a problem for kids who want to pick them up and pet them. The witch moths, however, were harmless, from a scientific perspective at least, but in Peru and the local Quechua, they were known as Taparaco and featured prominently in the folk tale of El Emisario Negro, the messenger in black, a dark stranger who brought a mysterious box to the Inca Huayna Capac. When he opened it, moths and butterflies flew out like the 4-and-20 blackbirds, but instead of singing for the king or snipping off maids' noses, they spread a plague. People in folktales were always doing stupid stuff like that. If reading Lang's colored fairy books had taught Howard anything, it was that if someone gives you a mysterious box, don't open it. There was never much good inside. Ask Pandora. Howard stuffed the brochure in his back pocket and ducked in through the main doors of the museum. He had overheard Fantasy saying that the Museo Larco had a world-renowned collection of pre-Columbian erotic pottery, and it had been ages since he'd gotten laid. The collection did not disappoint. Howard had to get down on one knee to look in all the cases, but was rewarded with the sight of pre-Columbian pottery figures getting their freak on as much as gnats could. There were even some seeming jokers among them. A bird woman with perky tits. A couple of alpaca jokers, or maybe just pottery alpacas, doing the wild thing. And a skull-faced joker with an oversized dick who looked like Charles Dutton's head on a pre-Columbian gnat's body with, well, Howard's own penis, if less warty and brown instead of green. Howard purchased the Museo Larco's coffee table book, then went back out to the gardens to wait for the limo to take him back to the hotel. A purple bougainvillea formed a pleasant bower in one corner, and a giant terracotta urn tipped on its side served him as a seat. Butterflies and moths fluttered near, still seeming to regard him with their owl eyes and wing spots. He fished a cigar out of his shirt pocket, an extremely fine gift from Fulgencio Batista, the aging president of Cuba, during their brief stop in Havana. He sniffed it to savor it one last time, then bit off the end with his snaggled yellow teeth, which served better than any cigar clipper. Howard spat the end into the bougainvillea and struck a safety match against his skin. He just inhaled a lungful of the sweet smoke when the limousine pulled up, UN flags fluttering prominently. Howard sighed, letting out a cloud of smoke which drove away the butterflies that kept mistaking him for a cactus. He got up, stubbing his cigar out against the urn. The chauffeur ignored Howard, opening the door instead to let out a tall, relatively speaking, blonde man in a linen suit who in turn offered a gallant hand to a petite but stunning woman. The man was Jack Braun, the infamous Golden Boy. The woman, Asta Lenza, prima ballerina for the American Ballet Theater, more famed as Fantasy, the ace whose dancing caused all men, and even some women, to desire her. Howard had a poster of her on the wall of his bedroom, Asta done up as Coppelia, the clockwork doll from the ballet of the same name, a souvenir of the night Dr. Tachyon had given him his ticket to the Met. Her coiffure for that performance had been tightly wound, brassy ringlets that bounced like springs. Today she wore a spiked platinum mullet, like Bowie's Goblin King. A goblin queen, and a fetching one at that. "Oh," she cried, her hand and arm moving in an elegant yet theatrical gesture, as she pointed to the air above the museum. "Oh, look, Jack, how beautiful!" Howard looked as well, watching as a migration of moths and butterflies crested over the roof of the former colonial mansion. Chartreuse and crimson, apricot and azure, sulfur and fuchsia, some even translucent, like a cascade of confetti viewed through a Tiffany window, but magically brought to life, their wings all the colors of the rainbow. Visitors to the garden gaped. Children laughed and pointed. Howard gazed in wonder himself, mystified as to their source. The kaleidoscope of lepidopterans whirled and spun, their patterns tumbling and transforming, a panoply of jeweled fragments. For a moment, a coven of black witch moths flew together, forming a shape that resembled a hooded figure, like one of Tolkien's ring wraiths, but just as swiftly broke apart, the black moths becoming dark traceries amidst their more colorful companions. Before Howard could follow their progress any further, Fantasy began her dance. To say she was beautiful was an understatement. To say she was absolutely mesmerizing was the truth. Asta was a dancer, lithe but muscled, supremely agile and in control of her body, as she gave herself over to sheer terpsichorean joy. Howard did not know all the names for what she did. Entrechat, pirouette, cabriole fouette, a graceful arabesque, and a grand jeté. He only knew that he wanted her. She moved like a butterfly, her dress a sheer wrap of delicately peach-tinted silk with full skirts slit to show off her amazing legs. Across her shoulders, trailing from each hand, she wore a gaudy native shawl, doubtless a recent gift from some admirer, woven with threads of cactus fruit pink and cornflower blue. Asta raised it above her head like moth wings, causing it to flutter as the butterflies swirled around her, drawn half by the colors, half by her movement and magnetism. All the men watching, Howard included, were held transfixed by her beauty, caught like a lepidopterist specimen's on a pin. There must have been a woman among them, for Howard dimly heard the clicking of a camera shutter. He could do nothing but watch, only able to move what muscles it took to follow her movements, entranced. Asta's spontaneous dance at last wound to a close as she sank to a spot in the center of the lawn, fluttering her shawl like a butterfly's wings as it comes to rest. She touched her head to her knee, bringing her arms forward to touch her calf, so the shawl's colors were fully displayed at the conclusion of her dance's coda. Applause erupted spontaneously, the noise and the movement causing the moths and butterflies to scatter. Howard shook off the last of his trance and became uncomfortably aware that the front of his jeans was tented by a raging hard-on. This was made even more embarrassing by the fact that it was at an average person's eye level. Fantasy rose, taking her bows for her impromptu ballet fantasia, surveying her admirers and her audience. She paused with an amused sidelong glance to Howard's crotch. "And to think," she remarked impishly, "we haven't even seen the erotic pottery collection yet, Jack." "Of course, Asta." Asta simply laughed. While Jack Braun might have been pleased because he knew she would be his tonight, Asta Lenzer would never truly belong to anyone but herself. December 19th, 1986, en route to Cusco. On board the stacked deck, people traded seats like Fantasy traded bed partners. All save Howard and Mordecai Jones. The Harlem Hammer required a chair with special reinforcements to withstand his immense weight. Howard required all that plus additional headroom, legroom, and width. He couldn't even stand up in the plane, so spent most of his time stretched out recumbent, staring at the ceiling or chatting with whomever had taken the seats beside him for that leg of the tour. This morning it was Father Squid and Archbishop Fitzmaurice, the tour's representative for Catholic Charities. The Archbishop was a gnat in his 60s with white hair with traces of red and an affable round face offset by silver-rimmed bifocals. He was also exceedingly unflappable, paging through Howard's book of pre-Columbian erotica with interest. "Oh, my," he exclaimed. "Some of these remind me of the obscure saints." He tapped a page and chuckled. "This gentleman resembled Saint Foutin." Howard looked over at the photograph. It was another one of the jokers with a giant dick. "We've got a guy sort of like that back at the clinic." "Oh?" Father Squid inquired, his tentacles curling with interest. "Is it Philip, the new janitor? I have told him there's no shame in a joker body, but he does not wish to reveal what he hides beneath that trench coat. And I'm afraid to say the church ladies have begun to speculate." No, Howard said. "Not Phil. Another guy." The Archbishop still marveled at the photograph. "I hope this poor man's joker is not precisely like Saint Foutin's." "Well, more proportional," Howard admitted uncomfortably. "That is good to hear, but still not precisely what I meant." Archbishop Fitzmaurice clarified. "One of these saints' icons is housed at a little parish in France. When they think the priest isn't looking, women sneak a hand beneath Saint Foutin's robe to touch him to ensure fertility. Sometimes they even chip off splinters." He leaned over conspiratorially, whispering. This obviously a favorite scurrilous anecdote. "You would think the saint's member would be worn away to nothing, and yet it is miraculously restored. Or maybe not so miraculously. Someone in the Middle Ages was clever enough to drill a hole through the statue and insert a dowel. Every so often, as needed, one of the priests uses a mallet to tap a little more out." Howard considered. Like most jokers, he was not entirely pleased with what the wild card had done to him. But at least it hadn't shoved a broomstick up his ass.
"This is an official saint of the church?" asked Father Squid.
"As official as St. Christopher, if less popular." Archbishop Fitzmaurice reached into his shirt collar and pulled out a silver medallion with the image of a bearded man with a staff giving a child with a halo a piggyback ride. "His Holiness took both their days off the universal liturgical calendar, along with those of the rest of the obscure saints, but parishes dedicated to them are still free to celebrate their feast days, as are any who hold a special veneration. Christopher is my Christian name, and I am not going to fly anywhere without my patron's protection." The Archbishop kissed his medallion and tucked it away, then gave Howard an appraising look. "Do you know, Mr. Mueller, you remind me very much of St. Christopher. He too was a giant among men, 5 cubits tall. That, I believe, is about 7.5 feet.
"I'm taller."
"I can see," the Archbishop acceded, "and if I've heard correctly, quite strong as well. But St. Christopher was even stronger, for he bore the Christ child across the river on his back, and with him the sins of the world. I doubt that even Mr. Braun could bear that burden."
"Golden Boy has enough of his old sins to bear," observed Father Squid.
"Truly," agreed the Archbishop, "Judas's sin is the greatest of all." The conversation was starting to stray into uncomfortable territory, especially considering Golden Boy was seated only a few rows away, still flirting with fantasy, so Howard asked,
"Did St. Christopher have warts, too?"
"Not that I'm aware of," said Archbishop Fitzmaurice amusedly, "but the oldest icons of him do give him a dog's head."
"There's a guy like that over at the Crystal Palace," Howard mentioned. "Lupo. Makes a good martini."
"I shall have to visit," said the Archbishop. "I appreciate a good martini."
So what happened to the dog's head? Howard asked.
After he carried our lord across the river, Christopher was rewarded with a human countenance. The archbishop swiftly added, Mind you, I am simply reciting the hagiography as I learned it as a child, well before the advent of the wild card.
Jesus was a joker,
Father Squid stated piously, his tentacles twitching.
And a hermaphrodite. I do not see why he/she would consider it a reward to make someone into a gnat.
Who are we to question the ineffable wisdom of the divine?
There is that, agreed Father Squid. What I will question, however, is why the Holy Mother Church has still not accepted the Church of Jesus Christ Joker as one of her parishes, nor even seen fit to declare a patron saint for wild cards.
Father Squid, the archbishop sighed, you are still a young priest. These matters take time. There are any numbers of patron saints who already deal with plagues. Roch, Sebastian, Godeberta, Camillus de Lillis. And truth to tell, it has only been 40 years. And sadly, there are matters of pride and politics to attend to. Societies that wish to have their patron saint named as having dominion over something as important as the wild card virus.
The wild card is more than just a plague,
Father Squid stated flatly.
I agree, conceded Archbishop Fitzmaurice, but then it becomes a question of which other saint should have dominion. St. Jude, who makes all things possible? Eustatius and his companions, the patrons of difficult situations? St. Spiridon, the wonder worker? Personally, I advise all those dealing with a wild card to pray to St. Rita of Cascia. For Rita of the Impossibles would seem the one most suited. That said, Rita's society is small, and Augustinian and Spiridon dealt both in miracles and plagues, so he's currently the front runner. But it would never be wise to count Rita of the Impossibles out.
Howard considered, trying to remember where he'd heard of Rita of the Impossibles before.
Didn't Castro say she helped the Dodgers win the pennant a few years back?
Heresy, declared Archbishop Fitzmaurice. That was the devil's work.
He unscrewed the cap of an airline bottle of gin, looked for something to mix it with, and failing that, swigged it straight.
Should have been the Red Sox.
I knew you were a Red Sox fan, Christopher.
Father Squid gave the archbishop a sidelong glance with his cephalopod eyes.
But a Dominican, too?
What are you talking about?
The archbishop paused, then added, But you're quite right. I'm a Franciscan.
My primary concerns are charity for the poor and healing for the sick and annoying the Jesuits. I must leave it to the Dominicans to deal with heresy.
He patted Father Squid on the arm. Like you, my good friend, the heretic.
I am not a heretic,
huffed Father Squid.
That's what she said, laughed Archbishop Fitzmaurice.
Ooh. Joan of Arc, said the archbishop, his blue eyes twinkling, and now she's a saint. He raised the gin in a toast.
Consider yourself in good company.